All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is April 20th. We're finishing up, maybe today, Chapter 13, Blood in Introduction to Cardiovascular Physiology. Maybe we'll finish that one today. All right, so the next test, let's talk about the next test a little bit. It is scheduled for the 29th. That's a little bit late, I think. It would be better on the 27th, but I'm not going to change the date. Okay. So we're going to keep that on the 29th. Now, the chapters that are going to be on the test will be 12 and 13, so muscle physiology and the cardiovascular physiology with blood. So just those two. Who's got a question? 12 and 13, April 29th. Okay. Everybody got that question? A question about the next one. What? The next test?
Yeah.
You mean exam 5?
Yeah. Because
oh, wow.
When you're online, you only have lectures.
Okay. I don't know much about exam 5 yet at the moment. Okay. I'll try to figure that out. But I just figured out exam 4 this morning.
Okay.
So exam 4 will be, the usual kind of thing. Partly exam figures. Yeah. I expect everybody to get 100 on that test. Question? Chapter 14 will be on test 5, yeah, for sure, because we will not skip that chapter. That's a good chapter. Okay? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, you didn't have a question. Okay. All right, so that's the deal. That's all I know for right now. Somebody had a question on skeletal muscle. I was going to write some stuff on the board, and that was, how many different kinds of calcium channels does skeletal muscle have? Because the book is a little funny in its discussion, but there are three kinds of calcium channels, and next time I'll write this on the board. Okay, you guys, listen up. Right, in the T-tubule, you got the voltage-gated channels. Those are the DHP receptors. All right, and then in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you got the calcium release channel. Sometimes we call those the ryanodine receptors. They're mechanically coupled to the DHP receptors. And in addition, you got a third kind of channel. You got a calcium-induced calcium release channel. So you got three kinds of calcium channels in skeletal muscle. As opposed to in the cardiac muscle, you don't have the ryanodine type receptor. You just have the voltage-gated in the T-tubule, and the calcium-induced calcium release channels that are in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that's a little confusing because in that nice skeletal muscle illustration, so the skeletal muscle illustration, you see the DHP receptors, you see the ryanodine receptors, but they don't have the calcium-induced calcium release channels in the picture. Okay, so it's missing from that particular diagram. Maybe if I have time, I can go over that a little bit. But I think the take-home point there is that that cardiac muscle does not have that mechanically coupled type receptor, which we call what the ryanodine receptor. Okay. All right, so that's some bookkeeping, and I think I passed the sign-in sheet around, so that's going around. All right, and so we're getting through with coagulation today. So what kind of reaction is coagulation? If you were going to just tell me in very short, two or three words, what is coagulation? Okay, it's blood clotting for sure, but I want a little bit more mechanistic idea of what's happening there. What's happening for coagulation?
Fibrin
formation, fantastic. That's what I want to hear, fibrin formation. Now what about what about agglutination? How would you describe that process to somebody? Is it similar or much different? Agglutination. Is it fibrin formation?
No,
it's not fibrin formation. What is it? It's an antibody-antigen reaction, right? And so for agglutination, make sure you know where the antigens are located. Make sure you know where the antibodies are located. And what's the interaction between them? All right, so we got a few closing comments for coagulation, which is fibrin formation. All right, you've got that extrinsic pathway and intrinsic pathway. Both of these pathways right here require, let me get my pointer options working. Okay. Require some metal ions. What's a metal ion that's necessary for coagulation to take place? In both the extrinsic common and intrinsic pathway, you need calcium. Okay, that's a metal ion. In both of these pathways right here, you also need phospholipids. Where do you get phospholipids from? Plasma membrane. Maybe when a plasma membrane gets damaged or ripped apart, that releases phospholipids. That's important. Okay. And intrinsic pathway. I don't know if you have an idea of what intrinsic means as opposed to extrinsic. So let's talk about that for a second. Intrinsic means, anybody have a clue what intrinsic means as opposed to extrinsic? Intrinsic is a property of the tissue itself, right? It's just a property of the blood itself. So the blood all by itself has the ability to coagulate. It doesn't need any kind of stimulus under the proper kinds of conditions, and usually the conditions are when it stops moving, right? When it's in stasis. So if you have a part of your body where blood isn't flowing, maybe atrial fibrillation, maybe that part of the heart isn't contracting, guess what's going to happen? Blood is going to coagulate inside a person's heart as a result of that. And you can imagine what that is like. That produces what? Disease, right? Pathology. That's a terrible process. Extrinsic pathway means that this is a blood clotting mechanism that can't happen by blood all by itself, but it needs some kind of stimulus from outside blood tissue. And that stimulus is tissue thromboplastin, and tissue thromboplastin is released into the blood when tissue is damaged. Okay, so that's why we call this extrinsic pathway. So for instance, if connective tissue around the blood vessel is damaged due to a laceration, then that tissue releases thromboplastin, and that activates this extrinsic pathway. And this is a relatively short pathway compared to the intrinsic pathway right here. So typically it's a little bit quicker. And this is the one that usually takes place, all right, when you damage a blood vessel and surrounding tissue. Let's see, what other some other things didn't I mention last time? I didn't mention vitamin K. Where do you, how does your body have sufficient vitamin K? Like all vitamins, can your body produce vitamins? No, they're a little bit too complex. We don't have the biochemical pathways. We've lost them through evolution. And so these vitamins you need to have in your diet, right? And vitamin K is important because it helps regulate calcium levels in the blood a little bit, but it also is necessary for the production of clotting factors in the liver, right? So in particular, vitamin K is necessary for the production of prothrombin. So if your body can't make prothrombin, guess what? No thrombin can be made, and if there's no thrombin, then fibrinogen can't be converted into fibrin. All right, so in order to have proper blood clotting function, you need to have proper vitamin K in your diet. Where do you find vitamin K in your diet? Yeah, green leafy vegetables. And what's your favorite one? Spinach is good. Broccoli is good. Okay, broccoli is really, really good. And of course, a lot of people don't like those kinds of things. They poke their nose up at broccoli. And I can remember a time when my little nephews were growing up, right? They would never eat any kind of green leafy vegetables. But that didn't stop them from horsing around. And when they were horsing around, guess what would happen to them? They'd bump their nose and invariably get a nosebleed. Okay, and then they would come to me, and of course I'd have to sympathize with them and plug their noses up so that the bleeding would stop. But I wouldn't be, I'd be kind of sympathetic. So I'd sit them down and then I'd talk about the extrinsic pathway and intrinsic pathway and the common pathway, you know, but these 10-year-olds just didn't, they just weren't so interested in that. And when I started talking about vitamin K from broccoli, that's when they really tuned me out. And I realized that these little guys would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli, okay? Well, they would get really strong. May I don't think that really mattered too much, okay? Okay, so proper diet does influence your clotting function. What else did I want to say about this? I think I'm pretty much done talking about it, except notice this nice positive feedback mechanism right here. where thrombin, which is produced in the common pathway, influences the production of activated factor 11 in this intrinsic pathway. Okay, and that positive feedback mechanism is responsible for producing proper clotting function in most individuals. All right, so the other thing that we see are anticoagulants. Okay, sometimes there are patients that need anticoagulation therapy, and sometimes actually even in a test tube when we draw blood from somebody, we don't want it to clot, all right, and we need to block blood clotting. So, for instance, there are calcium chelators. There are chemicals that can take calcium out of solution, like EDTA. I forgot what that means, but you probably don't want to know what that means anyway, but you can Wikipedia that to find out what it stands for. Ethylene di something something. Okay. Sodium citrate will absorb calcium from the solution and prevent blood clotting because calcium is necessary, right? All those different steps we just looked at in the intrinsic, extrinsic pathways. But can you give EDTA or sodium citrate to a patient to decrease their clotting function so that it sequesters calcium so that it takes it out of blood? Would that be a proper thing to do? Well, you'd stop their clotting function, which might be good for that particular patient. But what else is going to happen? What else is calcium important for? In your blood and in the extracellular space. You got to tell me. Muscle contraction, right? All right, well, so if you block up all that calcium, that person won't be able to breathe. What about synaptic transmission? Neurons won't communicate with each other, right? So these compounds are okay in a test tube, but of course you'd never think of giving that to a person. All right, but there are anticoagulants that can be given to people that act a little bit better, and that is heparin, right, which heparin blocks thrombin. There's also something called coumarin or coumadin that blocks clotting by inhibiting activation and vitamin K. All right, so these things are all useful. But you can see that there is an interaction with coumarin therapy with vitamin K. When you see vitamin K, what should you be thinking of? Where do you get that from? Your diet, right? So there's an interaction between administering proper coumarin levels in somebody and their diet. So when somebody is on coumarin or coumadin anticoagulation therapy, your clotting function has to be measured every so often to make sure that it's clinically effective, that you're not overdosing somebody on that anticoagulation therapy. And of course, that works best when somebody is in good control of their diet. They can't eat like a ton of broccoli 1 week and no broccoli the next because these have interactions with each other. So these anticoagulation therapies have to be looked at, and a person's diet has to be regulated to maintain proper levels. Okay. All right, well, as you can imagine, not only should you have something that produces blood clots when you damage a blood vessel, but you should have mechanisms in your body to dissolve a blood clot. All right, yeah, I think that's probably a really good thing. And so what is that term that we use to talk about two mechanisms that work in opposition to each other? Antagonism, right? And that's really important for coagulation as well, because when you, for instance, cut your finger and you have a little paper cut on your finger, maybe that's bleeding, where do you want that blood clot? Right there on your fingertip, right? You don't want that blood clot or that clotting mechanism to be activated and then all of a sudden your whole body turns into a blood clot, because of course that would be immediately fatal. And unfortunately that sort of happens to somebody when they get disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, right? If they're in such bad shape, their calcium levels are all disturbed, their liver function is disturbed, that happens, and that's really a sad case because it's really difficult to treat, okay? Well, there's something that prevents that from happening in normal people, and that is an enzyme that's called plasmin. Plasmin digests blood clots away, and it also localizes the area of coagulation to the area that needs to be protected, and that protects the rest of your body. So plasmin digests fibrin, and that dissolves a clot, for instance, after that tissue has healed, for instance. And so there is something called plasminogen, and plasminogen is converted into plasmin by kallikrein, right, so that that limits the extent of clot formation, but it also dissolves the blood clot after the tissue heals, right? So this is just a nice antagonistic mechanism, and the whole point of medicine is what? To bring people back into balance, right? To restore these antagonistic control systems that people normally have. Okay. I guess I don't have a slide on that, but plasmin has also been used clinically for certain circumstances. Maybe if somebody's having a heart attack or if somebody's having a stroke, if they're having the right kind of stroke in the brain. What does a stroke really mean? Does anybody know what stroke is? It's sort of like a heart attack in the brain. Okay? So there's a blood vessel that becomes plugged with a blood clot and that blocks off a blood vessel to a part of the brain. And why is that such a bad thing?
No oxygen,
right? So that part of the brain can't make ATP. That part of the brain is going to die. And that's one part of it, one possibility for a stroke. Another possibility of a stroke is if you have a blood vessel in the brain, instead of being blocked, maybe it breaks open. Maybe there's an aneurysm. That's another possibility of a stroke. So two causes of a stroke would be a blood clot or bleeding. Right, and they're exactly opposite from each other. Now, which kind of patient would be served by administration of plasmin? Somebody that has a bleed in the brain or somebody that has a clot in the brain? A clot, that's right. So if you give plasmin to somebody that has a bleed, that will do what for the bleeding? Make it a lot worse, right? That would be like immediately fatal. So you got to do some nice diagnostic tests to find out what is producing that stroke. Is it a blood clot? And if it is, then plasmin therapy might be a perfect thing to use, but it has to be used relatively early on in the insult. But fortunately, in LA County, there are a number of hospitals that can make that diagnosis and have something called tissue plasminogen activator, around TPA, which can be used to revascularize a part of the brain that's being blocked if they have a clot, or maybe even a part of their heart that is being blocked from blood flow because of a clot inside the heart. So that's pretty cool therapy. There is also an enzyme that we find in bacteria that can be used to dissolve a clot. That's called streptokinase. So maybe you've heard of TPA being used to revascularize tissue, or streptokinase. And both of those act by activating plasmin, which then breaks the clot down, and hopefully blood returns to those organs before they actually die, okay, before they necrose. So when you have tissue that's low on oxygen, we call that ischemic tissue. And if that ischemia is maintained for a long period of time, that tissue will actually die, and we call that necrosis. So there's a difference between necrosis and ischemia. So the job of this plasmin right here, or TPA or streptokinase therapy, would be to reverse the effects of ischemia before the tissue becomes ischemic. Because what happens to your heart once it necroses? Can it ever come back again? No. Once the tissue is dead, it's dead, right? Same thing for a person's brain. Okay, so some of these things are pretty fancy. All right, the pulmonary and systemic circulations. Please know and review this anatomy on your own, but I could ask you a few quick questions. Like the relationship between the pulmonary and systemic circulations, and we can start with by thinking about the heart. How many sides does a heart have? It's got two. What are those sides? Yeah, the right and left side. And those ventricles support how many different kinds of circulations? Two, right? And that is the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation. And if you were going to characterize the pulmonary and systemic circulations, what's kind of rattling around in your mind? What's the relationship between pulmonary and systemic circulations? Oh, I like somebody's thinking about oxygen. That's right. Okay. All right. Well, let me give you a hint. You're thinking along the right lines. Like, what the heck is an artery from anatomy? What's an artery? It's just determined by the direction of blood flow, not what the blood is carrying. So an artery takes blood away from the heart. Now, if we want to compare the pulmonary arteries and the aorta, which is a systemic artery, what can you tell? Well, those are both arteries because blood is flowing away from the heart. But now, what can you tell me about oxygen concentration in the pulmonary artery versus the aorta? They are kind of opposite each other, right? Okay. So the aorta is carrying oxygenated blood, or blood that's high, relatively high in oxygen. The pulmonary artery is carrying blood away from the heart, which is relatively poor in oxygen. But if you study that, that makes perfect sense, because the pulmonary artery is taking blood to the lungs so that it can release CO2 and absorb oxygen, right? Okay, so the pulmonary and systemic circulations are kind of opposite to each other in that sense. Okay. All right, so let's see. Yeah, make sure you know all these. Make sure you know all the valves. What kind of blood vessel does exchange take place in?
Capillaries.
Only capillaries. And why is that? Because they're thin. Arteries and veins are way too thick for the fusion to occur in. Okay. Okay. So let's see if there's anything I want to talk about here. Not too much, but make sure you know all this stuff, because this might even be an exam figure. I'm not sure. All right, so here's something that I don't think you picked up in anatomy, and that is blood flow. Okay, the direction of the blood flow determines whether something's an artery or a vein. Okay, and you got two sides of the heart. The left side over here is pumping blood through the systemic circulation, which is huge, which is everywhere in your body except your lungs. All right, the pulmonary circulation is relatively small. It's pumping blood only through the lungs, but not anywhere else in the body. So, in terms of resistance, what circulation do you think has more resistance to blood flow, the systemic or the pulmonary? Which one has more resistance? Which one is it harder to pump blood around through? The really small circulation or the big circulation? Okay, it's the large circulation. It takes more energy to pump blood through the systemic circulation than it does the pulmonary circulation, because the pulmonary circulation are relatively short. Now, I think you did in the lab on Poiseuille's equation, Poiseuille's law, maybe last week, right? And resistance was one of those terms. And as the resistance decreases, the flow increases. All right, okay. Now, one other thing about for physiology that I want you to appreciate, that the two circulations, here we have the systemic, right, and then here is the pulmonary circulation. What has to happen to the flow between these two different circulations? What about blood flow through the pulmonary versus blood flow through the systemic? Right, should they be similar? Should they be identical, or could they be different? Okay. One way to maybe make this diagram a little bit better, let me think about drawing it on the board once. All right, we got two circulations right here. I don't know if I can draw this. See if I can. We got heart. All right, we got heart right here. And we've got systemic, this might make the point, systemic capillaries right here. Okay, and then it's going to come back to the heart again. And this is going to go to what? Pulmonary capillaries. And of course, we need these capillaries for exchange. All right, so those are our two circulations, a little bit different diagram. I've just kind of straightened out some of the loops. All right, well, if the heart is pumping a certain flow through the systemic capillaries right here, and then it comes back to the heart, what has to be the flow through the pulmonary capillaries? Well, what happens if the flow is not equal? Let's just say that the flow for the systemic circulation is a lot greater than the flow through the pulmonary capillaries. How can that be? What's going to happen? If the flow is greater for the systemic compared to the pulmonary, that means what's happening to this pulmonary circulation? If the flow is reduced compared to the flow from the systemic, it's got to expand, right? It's got to get bigger. That blood has got to go someplace. If the heart is pumping more blood through the systemic than it is through the pulmonaries, then that blood is going to back up someplace, and it's going to expand. And if that continues, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to blow up, and there'll be blood all over the place, right? That's an ugly thing. So what I want to point out to you is that in a normal heart, the flow through the systemic circulation has to pretty much match up to the flow through the pulmonary circulation. They have to balance each other out, not second by second, but, you know, on the order of maybe a minute or something like that, that flow has to equal out. Okay. And since the resistance is different, the way that it equals out is that the heart regulates the pressure. So it takes a lot more pressure to pump blood through the systemic circulation than the pulmonary circulation. Okay. And what ventricle pumps blood through the systemic circulation? That would be the left ventricle. Through the pulmonary circulation would be the RV. And what kind of muscle can produce more pressure? A stronger muscle or a weaker muscle? A stronger muscle. And how typically do you think of a muscle as being really strong? Really big, right? So what size, how big is the left ventricle compared to the right ventricle in terms of the thickness of the muscle wall? The left ventricle is a lot thicker, right, because it has to develop more pressure, right? And the right ventricle doesn't have to develop the same amount of pressure because the resistance for the pulmonary circulation is not nearly as high. Okay, so the heart compensates by hypertrophying the left ventricle to produce more pressure to what? Maintain equal flow through both of these. Okay, so that's what's happening in the normal heart. So this is pretty important. The rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation because it's what? It's one big long loop. Blood can't take a side trip someplace. Okay, so that's something that you didn't know in anatomy. All right, but that also describes why the left ventricle is a lot thicker than the right ventricle. All right, heart valves. Make sure you know, well, I tell you what, let's just try it out right now. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
It's got four. All right, it's got two sides. So there's a right atrium and a right ventricle, and a left atrium and a left ventricle. Now, how many valves does the heart have?
Four.
That's right, four and four, so that's pretty easy to remember. So there are, how can we group these heart valves? Are they all a lot different, or do some valves share some similarities with other valves? Yeah, some share. Like, which valves would you like to lump together in a group? Like, for instance, the atrioventricular valves are very similar. Here is another atrioventricular valve. This is a valve between the atria and ventricles. Now, why are these valves there? What's the job of a valve? Yeah, to keep blood flowing in this constant direction all the time, preventing what we call retrograde flow. And why do you think that's a really good thing? What's going to happen to that heart if these valves aren't here? Well, how about, what would happen to you if I told you to walk up these stairs, but as you got halfway up, you have to walk down and then start again? But as you got halfway up, I would say, oh, sorry, come on back down, start at the beginning again. What would happen to you? Well, you'd croak. I don't know. You'd die in, I don't know, how long could you do that for? A couple hours? I don't know. Something like that. Maybe a day, some of you guys. Maybe 2 days, something like that. Same thing for the heart. If the heart is pumping blood and the blood got pumped forward and then flowed backwards, that's going to eventually kill the heart. So that's a really serious condition. Whether it is an atrioventricular valve or a semilunar valve, it wouldn't matter. All right, that would kill the heart. So valve disease is very important. It's got to be treated. It's got to be corrected if there is valve disease in somebody. All right, so make sure you know a try before you buy for the atrioventricular valves. And then the semilunar valves are just named after the blood vessel that they're in. Like this would be the pulmonary semilunar valve. And then one back down over here would be the aortic semilunar valve. All right, make sure you know something about papillary muscles and chordae tendineae and all that kind of stuff. So that's the function of those valves, to prevent retrograde flow. Okay. All right, in anatomy, I don't think we talked much about the functioning of the heart, maybe just a little bit. Okay. But the heart is not like your motor in your car or an electric motor that you maybe have someplace in your heart which can pump all the time, right? The heart, that was interesting, it was pump and heart both together. The heart is what we call a reciprocating pump, which means that sometimes it pumps blood and other times it's not pumping blood. And the times that it's not pumping blood, that means that blood is flowing into the heart, because when the heart contracts, there's got to be blood inside the heart in order for it to get pumped out. Right? So the heart can't be pumping continuously. And that's a problem that people can experience if their heart rate is elevated too much. It's always contracting, but there's not enough time during relaxation for the blood to fill up again. And when the heart contracts, then it won't be pumping any blood, and then blood pressure declines after that. Okay, so since the heart is a reciprocating pump, we define these two phases, two parts of the heart cycle. Right, systole refers to the contraction phase, and diastole refers to the relaxation phase of the heart. And for years and years and years, medicine and science was pretty much only interested in the contraction phase, because everybody thought that's the most important phase, right? But now everybody's interested in the relaxation phase as well, because systole can't pump blood unless the heart relaxes sufficiently to allow for filling to take place. Okay, so make sure you know systole and diastole. So you can probably imagine, let's think of pressure that is going to be produced in an artery, whether it's a pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation, doesn't really matter. All right, but when do you think the pressure is the highest? When the heart is relaxed or when the heart is contracting? When it's contracting, right? When you grab a balloon and squeeze down on the balloon, that's when the pressure inside that balloon goes up. All right, so pressure in blood vessels reaches a peak, right, during systole, and then the pressure dies away as the heart is relaxing during diastole, right? Because the heart can't generate pressure when it is relaxing. All right, so that kind of describes when you get your blood pressure taken, how many numbers do you get? You get two numbers, right? You get this peak number and you get the lowest number right here. So those are reported as the systolic versus diastolic pressures. And you should probably know what your blood pressure is. Okay. All right. So we can group the chambers of the heart into two kinds, the atria, which are superior, and the ventricles, which are inferior. The atria, what's the wall thickness of an atria compared to a ventricle? We talked about the right versus left ventricles, left being much more muscular than the right. But what about those atria compared to the ventricles? They're even dinkier, they're thinner, right? Because where do the atria have to pump blood? Through the pulmonary circulation or systemic? They only have to pump it across the atrioventricular valve, which is extremely low resistance, right? So they're not very strong muscles. But the job of the atria is to help load blood into the ventricles, so they contract first, and then a little bit later, the ventricles contract, about 200 milliseconds later. All right, so a good, and you're going to have to pay attention to this number probably for the rest of your life, because it changes around sometimes. Normal systemic blood pressure is 120 over 80. All right, and that's, so when I say systemic, what does that mean? That means the systemic circulation as opposed to the pulmonary circulation. Pulmonary circulation is about 25 over 10 millimeters of mercury, right? And you've probably measured blood pressure in lab. Was there a mercury column in lab? Probably not. We have these dials, right? Maybe there's one mercury column, but mercury is pretty toxic, especially to really young developing people. So we're trying to get rid of all mercury, but that's kind of the gold standard. Hopefully that little dial was calibrated sometime in the not-too-distant past to a mercury column, right? So this is millimeters of mercury. That's a measure of pressure, all right? I think right now, so for years and years and years, we're kind of holding this as the standard, 120 over 80. 120 is the systemic pressure. And, for instance, if somebody has a blood pressure of 150 over 80, what would we call that? And you would say high blood pressure, and you would be right, but we don't want to call that high blood pressure. We call that hypertension, right? And hypertension, we know, produces all kinds of cardiovascular disease, and it can produce strokes and heart attacks. It kills your kidney function as well. It will kill your kidney. So it's a very hypertension is very dangerous. All right, so this is a good number to shoot for. But recently, this number has been relaxed a little bit. I think for the test, if I ever test you on what normal blood pressure is, I want you to say 120 over 80, right? And if it's elevated, that's hypertension, very deadly. And if it's less than 120 over 80, that is what we call hypotension. And what are the possible deleterious effects of hypotension? Okay. Well, the lower your blood pressure is, the more protected you are from cardiovascular disease. So that's really a good thing. The lower your blood pressure, the better. The easier job your kidneys have to do, right? So it protects your kidneys, protects your heart, protects your blood vessels. That's good. But indeed, some people have blood pressure so low that when they change body position, they pass out. All right. Now, you can tell me what that is like. Is that good or bad? That's really bad when you pass out, right? Because right now, if you're going to stand up after class, if you pass out when you stand up, well, your head's going to bounce off the table, and it's going to bounce off the chair, right? And it's going to bounce off the floor. Just too much bouncing around. That's not a good thing. Or if you pass out during when you're driving down the 405, then that kind of bouncing is really bad, right? All right, so it's rare that we have to treat somebody for hypotension, but it's possible, all right? There might be some problems with their heart, and maybe they need a pacemaker or something like that. Maybe you're kind of familiar. We'll talk about all these things. But hypertension definitely is recognized as something very bad. And now we're kind of loosening this rule right here. So if you're a little bit elderly, maybe 140 over 80 is not such a bad thing. Okay? But I would kind of just always remember 120 over 80. Okay? So on any of the tests I would give, what's normal blood pressure? 120 over 80. All right, and if you want to know something more about that, then you got to talk with your physician. Okay. Okay. So what is systole again? That is contraction, heart contraction, and that's not the only phase the heart is in. It also has to relax, and that happens during diastole, right? So systole and diastole. All right, let's look at a couple more terms right here, having to do with the cardiac cycle. All right, so these chambers have a particular size. During diastole, when the heart is relaxed, the ventricle chambers expand, they get bigger, and when they contract, the volume gets smaller. So we're interested in the volumes of the heart. So the end diastolic volume, that's at the end of what? Contraction or relaxation? Relaxation, what size should the heart be? Should it be dilated the most or shrunk down the most? End diastole is the largest volume. That's at the end of diastole after blood has filled the heart, right? And so that's a large volume. End diastolic volume, and that's measured in milliliters, is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of relaxation, after the heart has filled up. And in order to have proper heart function, that should be a big number in healthy people. All right, as opposed to, let's look here, end systolic volume. That's the amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of systole. And what should that be? Should that be big or small? That should be the smallest volume, right? And if we subtract these two, guess what we get? We get the stroke volume. That means the amount of blood that's been pumped out of the heart as it goes from diastole to systole. So the stroke volume is the amount of blood ejected from the ventricles during systole, and you can measure that if you know the end diastolic volume and the end systolic volume. Okay, so how would you calculate stroke volume? It's one minus the other. What's the minus one? Okay, would be the systolic volume. Right, so you take the end diastolic volume and subtract the end systolic volume from it, and that gives you the stroke volume of the heart. Okay, the amount that's pumped every time it contracts. So which volume is larger, ESV or ESV? Oh, look at that. Okay, ESV or ESD? Which is larger? And, oh yeah, EDV, D for diastolic. That's the bigger one. All right, change your notes. All right. All right, and then be able to calculate what is the stroke volume if the end systolic volume is 20 mLs and the end diastolic volume is 80 mLs. All right, that you probably could do that in your mind. Okay, so that would be 60 mLs, right? Okay. So as the ventricles contract, right, the pressure rises, And we're going to have to look at a really nice diagram that shows volume and pressure within the chambers of the heart and when valves are doing certain things. Okay. And so I think I'm going to go right at this point to this diagram. This diagram is okay, but you know, there might be one or two mistakes on this one right here, which maybe you can find. So I think the diagram that I really want to go to, which I like a lot, is this one that's in your lab manual. Now, there are some mistakes of this diagram that are in your lab manual, which I've corrected on this sheet right here, and I've kind of added some things to it. Okay. I didn't put this into the PowerPoint, but I should, but it's in Blackboard under documents or study guides or something like that. Okay, so we want to be really familiar. This is an exam figure, all right? So you can just work in your lab book, but let's look at some of these different graphs that we have here. All right, so in order to appreciate a graph, what do we have to know? We got to know the axes, right? That's always the first thing that you want to look at, right? So here we have the vertical axes versus this horizontal one right here. This is time, right? So we have a number of parameters versus time. Now, the really cool thing about this illustration right here is that all of these different parameters are justified in time correctly. So you can see how things relate to each other in the same time sequence, all right? And when you're thinking of the heart, what are the two main phases again? Systole and diastole. Okay, so what are the things that we're going to look at during the heart cycle? We've got pressure. Okay, we're going to look at pressures in three different places. We're going to look at pressure in the aorta, which is this dotted line right here. We're going to look at pressures in the ventricle, maybe let's say left ventricle, as this solid line. And then we're going to look at pressures inside of the atria. Maybe just the left atrium. So we got pressure versus what? Time. Okay, and these are in seconds, like 0.2 seconds. That's 200 milliseconds to give you a feel for what's going on here. And then justified in time is a plot of volume versus time. Volume of the left ventricle. All right, and does the volume of the left ventricle change during the cardiac cycle? Does the volume of the left ventricle change? Oh, I hope so, right? Because otherwise it doesn't pump any blood if it doesn't change volume, right? So we're going to look for an end diastolic volume and an end systolic volume. We're also going to look at electrical activity of the heart, right? And we call that, what do we call the electrical activity of the heart? As measured from surface electrodes on your body. Or what's even better yet would be like needle electrodes, subcutaneous electrodes that we put underneath the skin of somebody. Did anybody volunteer for that in lab? Huh? The needle electrodes? Oh, you did? You didn't know it? Well, maybe the next lab you can do those little subcutaneous electrodes. Okay. All right, so this is electrical activity of the heart. What do we call that electrical activity of the heart measured with surface electrodes? That's called the electrocardiogram. Cardio has to do with the heart. Myocardium has to do with the heart. And electro means the electrophysiology. We're measuring the electrophysiology of the heart. And then we also have a couple little blurbs down over here that we would appreciate with a stethoscope. What's a stethoscope? That's something that you listen, right? So it's like an audio track of what's happening inside your heart. So all of these things are different. Pressure is different than volume, and volume is different than the electrical activity, and electrical activity is different than the sounds that your heart makes. So we put them all on this table right here. All right, so make sure that you can place these answers properly on, match things up. All right, so let's look at the pressure inside the left ventricle. All right, so here we see the pressure, the heart starting to contract. And the signal for heart contraction, all right, it's not really the same thing, but it's a signal for heart contraction. We look down here at the ECG. What wave in the ECG is the signal for contraction? It is the QRS complex. So the QRS complex, does it happen at the same time that contraction happens? if you look at this diagram right here? What can you tell me about QRS relative to when contraction starts and pressure starts to build inside the ventricles? The QRS happens first, right? That's the signal that starts that excitation-contraction coupling. So the ventricle starts to contract, pressure rises, okay? And this other little solid line right here is pressure inside of the atrium, okay? Now, how is a fluid like blood going to flow? What's going to be the motive force for flow of blood from one place to another? A pressure. So blood can only flow from high pressure to low pressure, right? Okay. All right, so what we see right here, right at this point in time, the pressure in the ventricles is what? Greater or less than pressure in the atria? Right here, it is greater than the atria, right? So blood in the ventricles is going to want to flow back into an atrium, right? Because blood flows from high pressure to low. But something better stop it. What's going to stop it?
A valve.
What kind of valve? An atrioventricular valve, an AV valve. All right, so the AV valve closes because blood starts to go back into the atria, but that inflates the cusps of the AV valve, causing it to slam closed. All right, and so it slams closed. What else do we appreciate? We hear the first heart sound. The first heart sound happens when an AV valve closes shut, right? And that happens when the pressure in the ventricle is greater than the atria, which happens right here at this point in time. Okay, well, the ventricle continues to contract, right? But at this point in time, the AV valve is closed, but the aortic valve is closed as well during this time. So if all the valves to the left ventricle are closed and the heart is contracting, where can the blood go? It can't go anywhere. If all the doors to the ventricle are closed, what happens is that the size of the ventricle doesn't change as the pressure increases, so the volume doesn't change. We call this area right here isovolumetric contraction because the volume of the heart is not changing. The pressure is rising, but then all of a sudden the pressure in the ventricle, which is a solid line, is now higher than the aorta. Right? And when it's higher than the aorta, guess what happens? Right at this point right here. Blood can flow from the ventricle into the aorta because it's higher in the ventricle, but what has to happen in order for that to happen? The aortic semilunar valve has to open up. Right? And the ventricle opens up the aortic semilunar valve, blood flows out of it. All right? So that's what happens right here. Oh, yeah, it's between 1 and 2. Isovolumetric contraction. Yeah, isovolumetric contraction. All right, so how do I know that's isovolumetric? Well, let's look at the volume curve of the ventricle. And notice between 1 and 2, can you see that what is the change in volume of the ventricle? It's not much, right? So we call that isovolumetric contraction. It's contracting, but the volume of the ventricle doesn't contract. But right here, because there's higher pressure in the ventricle than the aorta, the aortic semilunar valve opens, and when it does, blood is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure, and what happens to the volume of the ventricle when the aortic valve opens? It's pumping blood out of the heart during this period of time, and we see that the volume of the ventricle now decreases as the ventricle contracts, pumping blood into the aorta. Now, what happens to pressure in the aorta when the ventricle is pumping blood into it? That's this dotted line. It now increases, right? So this is the pressure that we normally measure with somebody with a pressure cuff, right? And what do we measure? We measure this point right here, which is the diastolic pressure, and then we measure this one right here, which is the systolic pressure. So these are the two pressures that we measure in somebody. Okay. All right, and then after the contraction of the heart or systole of the heart pumps all the blood out of the heart that it can, like down over here, then the volume is not going to change anymore. The pressure is going to start to decrease in the ventricle, and it's going to decrease below the pressure in the aorta, so blood is going to want to flow from the aorta back into the ventricle, but can it in a normal heart? No. Because why? Which ones? Okay. The aortic semilunar valve closes right here. Aortic semilunar valve closes, right? And that maintains the pressure in the aorta. It produces this little notch in the aortic pressure curve right here. We call that the dicrotic notch, because when the aortic semilunar valve closes, it kind of flows backwards a little bit until the leaflets approximate each other. Right? And when that aortic valve closes, guess what happens? You hear another heart sound. The second heart sound is when the semilunar valve closes. And then the pressure, so the semilunar valve is closed and the AV valve is closed. So this period of time right here, I think probably by this F right here. Now this is another, if we look at the volume, here's the volume of the left ventricle. Is the volume changing very much between 4 and 5? It's not. All right, so this is another isovolumetric period. It's not isovolumetric contraction, it's isovolumetric. What's happening to the heart? Is it contracting or relaxing? It's relaxing. So that is isovolumetric relaxation taking place during this time, because both valves are closed. But as the pressure in the ventricle decreases below the atrial pressure, right? So we have high pressure in the atria during this period of time right here, low in the ventricle. Which way is blood going to want to flow? It's going to go from the atria into the ventricles, and so that opens up the the AV valve right here. So here's where the AV valve opens up, and blood starts to flow into the ventricles. And what happens to the size of the ventricle when blood flows in it? All right, it starts to get bigger again. Okay? All right, so know the couple isovolumetric periods right here, contraction and relaxation. What valves are opening or closing during these heart sounds, and why these valves open up or close, right? And that you can see from the differences in pressure between the atria and the ventricles on this graph right here. All right, so this is a pretty classical graph of the events that happen during the cardiac cycle. So I know you're going to have to spend some time with it. I kind of spiffed it up a little bit compared to what you have in your lab manual so that it makes a little bit more sense. But this is a really good exam figure. But I don't think you can do well just if you memorize it. I think you have to really work with it enough to get an understanding of what's happening here. All right, why valves open up, why valves close. Okay. And next time, if you have some questions, we can go over this again. All right, so here is a similar kind of figure. All right, so the first heart sound is closing of the AV valves. The second heart sound is produced by closing of the semilunar valves. Okay, and that happens when there are pressure changes between the atria and the ventricles. All right, and those valves are very important because it prevents retrograde flow of blood. And if blood is flowing backwards in your heart, what's going to happen to your heart? It's going to die. And nobody wants their heart to die. So if you have valve disease, that has to be dealt with clinically. Either it has to be repaired if possible, or maybe it has to be replaced. A heart valve has to be replaced. And do you know what you can get a heart valve replaced with? Couple really good choices. Yeah, the pig heart, like you saw in anatomy, well, you haven't seen a human heart, but a pig heart is very similar to a human heart, all right? And pigs are pretty cheap, so it's pretty easy to get a valve from a pig and put it in a person, so pig valves. But what's the downside to that? When you put some tissue that's not designed for your body, it has different antigens. Okay, rejection, just like if you have a transfusion reaction, right? You have an antibody-antigen reaction. Your immune system will try to kill that particular tissue. Okay, so that's the downside to that. So maybe a better fit would be a human valve from a cadaver. Right, that's a little bit better fit, but what's the downside for a human valve from a cadaver? Rejection, same thing. But there's actually another downside too, and that is we always test for HIV and hepatitis and things like that, but when you do a test and we have humans doing it, what's the possibility? You get it wrong. You got errors, right? So you always have some small risk of getting some infection from a cadaver, and that could be a bad type of infection. So another alternative would be a prosthetic valve that's made out of plastic and metal and things like that. All right, but there are downsides to that. The upside is that we don't have to worry about rejection. You can't reject something that isn't living tissue. You don't have to worry about infection quite so much, but anytime you place a prosthetic, whether it's a pin in a bone or a part of the heart, there's also a possibility of infection, usually not quite so bad. But what is the big problem if you have this big hunk of metal or plastic that's being slammed around inside your circulatory stream? It can damage tissue. In particular, it can trigger coagulation. And that's one of the worst places you want coagulation, is inside the heart. Okay, so when somebody has a prosthetic valve, they have to be on anticoagulation therapy for the rest of their life. All right, so that's why we talked about heparin and Coumadin and how you have to adjust Coumadin with diet and just over time. Okay, so it's relatively easy to diagnose valve problems because they produce abnormal sounds in the heart. And any kind of abnormal sound in the heart is what we call a murmur. Murmurs can be produced by holes in the heart or valves that aren't working properly. Okay? All right, so they're produced by any kind of abnormal blood flow pattern. They can be produced by defective heart valves, and defective heart valves can be congenital, which means what? You're born with them, okay? That could be due to some problem during gestation or maybe inherited through genetics, right? Or they can be really developmental. You can acquire these valve problems due to infections, right? It could be due to viral infections or even bacterial infections. Rheumatic fever is damage can occur from antibodies that your body produces to fight the infection, the streptococcus infection. And those antibodies cross-react with your own heart tissue. So that's an autoimmune disease. That's kind of unfortunate when that happens. And then, of course, if that person wants to stay alive, then they need a valve replacement when that happens. All right, that's a pretty serious surgery. All right, there's other bacteria that can attack the heart, like Streptococcus mutans, various kinds of lactobacilli. Actually, these right here don't attack the heart necessarily. Well, at least I don't know of any direct evidence, but these are the bacteria that can form dental caries or cavities, okay? So without these bacteria, guess what? You would have no dental cavities. That's pretty nice. So what is one track that sometimes we take to protect people from various kinds of infections, whether it's virus or bacteria? You can get immunizations, right? You can get a shot, like who had the flu virus injection, immunization? Yeah, so your body can develop a good response, immune response, through vaccinations. And it is possible to develop a vaccine against this mutans and lactobacilli bacteria so that your body produces antibodies that kill these bacteria and you would never have dental caries. So that sounds pretty cool. All right, that works really, really nice. The downside is that those antibodies cross-react with a person's heart tissue. And so not only won't you have dental cavities, you won't have a heart because your immune system now attacks the heart. That's just cross-reactivity. So guess what happened to that vaccine? It's not available, obviously, okay, until they figure out how to prevent that cross-reaction from taking place. Okay, so the heart tissue is kind of delicate tissue. It can be damaged by infection. It can be damaged by your own immune system. Okay. All right, so different kinds of heart... Oh, let me start the program. different kinds of heart murmurs. Okay. Different kinds of valve disease. Okay, there's something called stenosis. Stenosis is a valve disease. Okay, not because the valves don't close properly, but because they don't open properly. And if they don't open all the way, then blood has much more difficulty going across the valve from the atria into the ventricles, or from ventricle into an artery, like an aorta. All right, so that impairs blood flow. And when that blood flow is impaired, it makes a squeaking or squishing sound, which trained people can hear with a stethoscope. All right, so that's one kind of murmur. Okay, other kinds of murmurs might be produced by valves that don't close properly, so blood squirts back from a ventricle into an atria, and that makes a squeaking sound. All right, and that's all pretty easy to see on ultrasound and MRI images. So anytime you have a valve that isn't working properly, we call that an insufficient valve or an incompetent valve. And insufficient and incompetent valves are due to, what's that due to? What produces an incompetent valve? This is a structure-function relationship. When the structure of the valve is abnormal, right, then that produces that murmur, right, which is a physiologic effect. Right, so there's a relationship between the structure of the valve and the physiology of the heart. Right, so there's always that relationship right there. Okay. All right, so where can we see some of these? Oh, so not only valves produce heart murmurs, but we can have holes in the heart. Like here is a hole between the left atrium and the right atrium. This is what we call the foramen ovale. Okay, and when you're born, that closes, right, in the fetal circulation. This is a really good thing to have that bypasses the lungs, so blood doesn't have to flow through the lungs in an unborn person. And that usually closes over, but it doesn't close over in everybody. It remains a hole. And then we call that a patent foramen ovale, or a PFO, right? Remember, the foramen ovale turns into the fossa ovalis, right? But if it remains open, then there's a hole in somebody's heart right here, and you can hear that as well, or see it on an echo or an MRI. And sometimes it's kind of a minor hole, and people can live to be maybe even 50 years old before it becomes clinically significant to them, all right, if the hole is small enough. But eventually it has to be repaired, because you can't replace the atria unless you get a heart transplant, right? So usually it's just sewn closed. And for years and years and years, that would require open heart surgery, right? You have to do a thoracotomy, crack somebody's chest open, right, go through the pericardium, open up their heart, sew it closed. But a couple years ago, some people up at Stanford figured out how to do this orthoscopically. So now they can just feed instruments through, I think, saphenous vein in somebody's leg up to the heart and actually repair that patent foramen ovale. And they probably go home the next day, which is pretty amazing, okay? Maybe not, but pretty doggone close to that. So that's pretty amazing. There can be interventricular septal defects right here, right, where blood is going to move from the left to the right ventricle during, what phase of the heart cycle? When is that going to happen? When these chambers become pressurized, that happens during systole, right, when the ventricles are contracting. And it always happens that blood flows from the left ventricle into the right ventricle. That would be a good test question. Why does it always flow from left to right, but not from right to left?
High pressure to low.
Because blood can only flow from high pressure to low. And what ventricle develops the most pressure? It's the left ventricle, right? So blood always squirts into the right ventricle. And so that makes the heart contraction very inefficient. And guess what's going to happen to the heart if that's not corrected? Well, that's going to kill the heart too, right? So that has to be corrected. Okay. All right. Let's talk about some electrophysiology of the heart. And probably you know that electrical events in the heart are very important. What's the basis of these electrical events in the heart? Action potentials, for instance, because remember, there's sodium channels, potassium channels. They open and close, right? So there's sodium currents and potassium currents. The membrane potential changes, and the heart is made out of millions and millions of these cells, and we can measure all of this electrical activity if it's added up together on even the surface of your body. Okay, so what are some things that I have to talk about here? Well, y'all know that myocardial cells are short, they're branched, and they contain certain kinds of synapses between all the cells of the myocardium. Well, almost all the cells of the myocardium. What kind of synapse do we find between myocardial cells? Electrical synapses, because they have a special structure in the intercalated disc. What is that special structure that allows for that electrical communication? That gap junctions, right? So that allows sodium to move from one cell into the neighboring cell. And in electrophysiology, what do we call that when sodium enters a cell? That's depolarization, right? Okay. All right, so all the cells are connected up to each other. The heart is kind of strange because it does not necessarily need stimulation to contract. It has what we call autorhythmicity, because there are certain cells, especially up over here, right where the superior vena cava enters the right atrium right here, that will spontaneously depolarize without even nervous innervation. Right, so the heart will contract on its own. Even if we remove a heart from a mammalian body, the heart on a table will contract by itself because of the nodal cells that are in this sinoatrial node right here. Like what movie was that? That was before your time. Raiders of the Lost Ark. You didn't see that? Is that before your time? Okay, good. Okay. All right, so these cells depolarize spontaneously because they have a pacemaker potential. Okay? So this is a plot of membrane potential versus time, right, in millivolts versus time. And this is without stimulation. And what is kind of, so these are action potentials of nodal tissue. So I want to break the tissue in the heart into two basic kinds. One is nodal tissue, and one is contractile cells. So nodal cells versus contractile cells are going to have different electrical activity. So you can see that if we have an action potential, it's followed by another action potential, and it's followed by another one. These nodal cells then cause the heart to contract, and it defines the autorhythmicity of the heart. All right, so we want to, in a nerve, how do we explain an action potential in a neuron? What do we use to explain an action potential? What membrane components? What membrane components in a neuron can explain an action potential? What part of a neuron can produce an action potential? Only the axon, yeah, starting at the axon hillock. Because what special part of the what's added to the membrane in an axon that allows that to happen? Yeah, you got voltage-gated channels, right, that open or close, and if the membrane voltage reaches threshold, they open up, okay? Well, we're going to see a similar thing in the heart with just a little difference. Notice that there is no stable resting membrane potential in these nodal cells. This is not a contractile cell, but these are nodal cells, right? As soon as these cells are repolarized, guess what they start to do immediately, all by themselves? They start to, what do we call that, going from like minus 60 to minus 50 right here. Yeah, they start to depolarize. And how do you typically explain depolarization? Sodium entry in the cell. Okay, so these nodal cells right here have special HCN channels. Okay, once these cells are hyperpolarized, these channels open up, and they open up for sodium. So sodium starts to leak all by itself into the cell. And how can sodium start leaking into the cell when that channel opens up? Because sodium is high on the outside, low on the inside because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump, right? So sodium just diffuses into the cell via these HCN channels. And when it reaches this point right here, There are some other channels that we don't see in a neuron, but these are voltage-gated, not sodium channels, but calcium channels. And where do you know calcium to be at a high concentration, inside the cell or outside? It's high outside. So when these calcium channels open up because it has reached threshold, what happens to the membrane potential of these nodal cells? As calcium enters, what happens to membrane potential? Does it become more positive or less positive when a cation enters? More positive, right? So that's what causes this massive depolarization here, right? Calcium channels depolarization due to these voltage-gated calcium channels that open up. All right, so this thing right here, due to the HCN channels, we call a pacemaker potential. Nodal cells have a pacemaker potential due to the HCN channels. And then after depolarization, these potassium channels open up that causes repolarization. And when it's repolarized, then these leaking sodium channels cause depolarization to happen once again. So this process happens over and over and over again in what kind of cells in the heart? The nodal cells. Okay. Now the area that has the steepest slope right here, which depolarizes the fastest, is what we call the SA node. So this node right here is what we call the pacemaker of the heart because it has the fastest inherent rhythm to produce those action potentials. And once this area depolarizes, guess what happens to this area over here? How does it depolarize? How does it know what's happening over here at the SA node? Because there are gap junctions between all of these cells, right? So you depolarize this cell over here, then all of these neighboring cells depolarize, and then eventually we're going to see that the whole heart depolarizes because the whole heart pretty much is connected with those gap junctions. Okay. So that's why the heart is autorhythmic. Now, if there's damage to the SA node right here, there are other tissues that have the HCN channels, just not as many of them. So they're slower to depolarize, but if the SA node isn't depolarizing, then another pacemaker will develop in the atrium or maybe even in the ventricle down over here, and then that will control the heart rhythm. And those kinds of pacemakers we call ectopic pacemakers because they're a pacemaker in an area other than the normal location, which would be here in the SA node. Okay. So typically, ectopic pacemakers have no effect on the heart because they're overridden by the inherent fast rhythm of the SA node. Okay. All right, let's talk about the contractile cells of the heart. We're done talking about the pacemaker or the nodal cells. All right, and this is what their action potential looks like. Does that look similar to an action potential from a nodal cell? No. How is it different? It's a lot wider. That's a really important feature. All right, so let's take a look and see what's happening here. So if a myocardial cell gets stimulated from an action potential in a neighboring cell, that is going to open up voltage-gated sodium channels. And you see when that voltage-gated sodium channel opens up, that causes more voltage-gated sodium channels to open up, just like you saw in a neuron. So you have this rapid depolarization phase, right, due to what? Sodium channels, okay? Now here is a big difference that we've never seen before. Here we see that depolarization is maintained for a long period of time, almost 200 or so milliseconds. We call this the plateau phase of this action potential, and this is due to another membrane channel that's placed in the cell membranes of myocardial contractile cells, and it's a calcium channel. These are slow to close. So during this period of time, calcium is going to enter the cell, causing what? Depolarization. It maintains depolarization during this phase, but finally there are enough potassium channels that open up right, at the end over here, and that causes repolarization of these contractile cells. All right, so if you look at this right here, okay, what can you tell me about some electrical properties of action potentials as opposed to graded potentials? What can graded potentials do? They can summate, right? So you can have a graded potential be an excitatory or inhibitory. They can cancel each other out. They can add to each other, right? But what about action potentials? Can they summate? They cannot summate. They're all or none, right? So once they depolarize, they cannot depolarize again until they go through their, what, absolute refractory period and relative refractory period. So there are refractory periods. So because of this plateau region, what can you tell me about the refractory period of heart contractile cells? Is it short or is it relatively long? It's relatively long. So the refractory period of these contractile cells is relatively long, and that's a really wonderful thing, because maybe you've been walking down the street and then all of a sudden you get a muscle cramp in a skeletal muscle. It goes into tetanus. Okay? Now what about myocardial tissue? Can myocardial tissue go into tetanus? It can't because of this plateau phase of an action potential of these myocardial cells. So because of the electrophysiology of heart tissue, the heart can't seize, which is a really good thing, because if your heart is seized in tetany, is it pumping any blood? And then what does that mean for you? That means how many seconds of consciousness do you have if your heart is contracted and can't relax? Yeah, about 3 seconds of consciousness. All right, and then when does your brain actually die? 3 minutes. I think we talked about this at the beginning of class, right? So if no oxygen is getting to your brain, 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, 3 minutes, then your brain has necrosed and it can't come back. All right, so this protects all of these oxygen-loving tissues in your body. So you got to know this plateau phase and what causes this plateau phase and what the bottom line is. The bottom line is then that prevents the heart from going into tetany. Okay. All right, so we got 12:50. So that's end of lecture. And we'll finish up this chapter on Thursday.